So, after several weeks of dealing with Christmas and then beginning the new year, we studied the most important verse in my mind in the entire Bible for 4 weeks, John 3:16. Today we're going to return to our study of the book of Genesis. And I want to do that by asking this question right up front. What would paradise look like to you? So if you could be the designer, the engineer of paradise, have you ever thought about this? What would you include in it? And I'm going to give you about 60 seconds to talk to your neighbor and say, if I was putting paradise together, it would definitely include this. So go ahead, talk amongst yourselves. What would paradise look like to you? All right, so as you're talking to your neighbors, I can't help but notice that as you're speaking about paradise, a lot of you are smiling and laughing. I don't know if you're laughing because you're embarrassed by your definition of paradise, or if you're laughing because the very thought of that could be funny. But the point is this: life now is not as it is supposed to be. In the third chapter of Genesis, we see the story of paradise lost. And now we're going to get back into our study here, and we're going to be introduced for the very first time to the biblical principle of sowing and reaping. Now, although fallen man is going to be rescued from the guilt of his sin, he still has to face the consequences of his sin. Because this principle of sowing and reaping is one that is often misunderstood. Many people think that we can be forgiven of sin, then we don't have to be accountable for sin. And that is just not true. Forgiveness does not erase accountability. Sin unleashes evil into the world and into the lives of the people that we love. And even though we can be forgiven of that sin, those consequences can remain for some time. And the consequences that we are going to read about today have remained to this very present day, and they are going to remain until Jesus comes back. So as I read this text to you, I'm not sure it's God saying so much, this is what I'm going to do to punish you for your disobedience, as it is more of God saying, this is going to be the consequence of your disobedience. So Genesis chapter 3, beginning in the 16th verse, is where we're going to pick up. I'd encourage you to read from your own Bible and not try to squint at the screen. Genesis 3, 16. To the woman, he said, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain, you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. To Adam, he said, because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. Now notice two reasons that God gives for the judgment, and they were both mentioned to Adam. And I want you to not miss that God does not charge Eve with ultimate responsibility for the fall. He does not say to Eve, like he did to the serpent back in verse 14, and like he does to Adam in verse 17, because you have. Paul says very clearly that sin came into the world because of one man. And I'm not saying that Eve did not sin. I'm not saying that her sin was not serious. She was deceived by the serpent. It's a sin to be deceived. And she experienced serious consequences because of her sin. But the loss of paradise was not primarily laid at her feet. Guilt for the fall was assigned to Adam. And notice the first thing he is charged with is denying the order of spiritual leadership that God had established. God said, because you listened to your wife. Now, let me just give a quid pro quo. God is not saying to husbands that you do not have to listen to your wives. What he is saying is that Adam knew that eating that fruit had spiritual implications, and God faulted Adam for not being a spiritual leader of his home. You ever wondered why Satan went to the woman first? Why did he begin to introduce sin into paradise by first seducing the woman? Let me give you my thought on that. He is defying the created order. Because Satan's basic problem is submission to authority. The very idea of being submissive to God, giving to God the highest praise and being humble for God was something that he could not take. And he tried to rebel against God. And ever since, Satan has had a problem with authority. So he went immediately to Eve to subvert the order that God had established in the home. That's why, notice when God comes into the garden in the cool of the day and Adam and Eve are hiding from him, he first says to Adam, "What have you done?" He first called Adam into account because spiritual protection against hellish falsehoods was his priority. Not only did Adam not protect his family from the wrong voice, but he chose to personally rebel against the right voice. God says, first, you listened to the voice of your wife, and second, you ate from the tree about which I commanded. Understand, Adam's sin is not deception. Adam's sin is defiance. He defied God's place to set limits that he did not want to keep. The real issue of the fall is the authority of God's word. Will God's word have authority in your life, or will you defy it? Will you listen to another voice instead? Who you are going to listen to is the question that is still behind every temptation we face. And what follows is, I believe, is God's description of what life on earth would be like because of the evil that was unleashed when Adam listened to the wrong voice. And I think it's interesting that God said to the woman it would be the judgment in the arena of relationships, her children, her husband, and to Adam, judgment in the arena of his work. Remember, there's only been two commands that have been given up until this point. They were told back in chapter 1 to be fruitful and multiply. And then in chapter 2, they were told to care for the garden. The very two areas where God had commanded them were now the two arenas where they're going to have misery as a part of their existence. Family and work are going to be totally changed now that sin is a part of the world. So let's just go ahead and look at what's going to happen to the woman and to the man because of sin. And I want to say up front, some of what I am going to talk about today will be a little uncomfortable to hear. A few of these things are my opinions, and you can do with them what you want. But God says clearly here that this is what life is going to be like, not just for Adam and Eve, but for all people. For example, the first thing that's going to happen for the woman because of sin is there is going to be pain in childbearing. God said, I will greatly increase pain in childbearing. Now, ladies, be quick to note the penalty is not children. The penalty is the pain associated with bearing children. And by the way, the word included in the original language, it includes this whole idea of conception all the way through pregnancy. God says that the whole task from the moment of conception to birth is going to be one that is coupled with pain. Now, obviously, I have to be very careful here because I can't begin to imagine what that is like. I was in the delivery room for both of my boys when they were born. And I knew that Shannon was a strong person. But you guys who are not married or your wife has not given birth, you do not know how strong a woman is until you are beside her when she gives birth. It is phenomenal how strong she must be. God says there will be pain involved with bringing life into the world now because of sin. I have a friend I graduated Bible college with who ministers in Indiana. A few years back, he passed a kidney stone and he made the mistake from the pulpit of saying, "Ladies, now I know what you go through when you give birth." Well, one morning that next week when he came into his office, on his desk in his office was an 8-pound rock with a note that said, 8-pound kidney stone. There is not a man in this room that knows what it is like to give birth, and none of us are eager to find out. I take it to mean that Eve would never experience the relatively little, if any, amount of pain that could be associated with procreation. And the point is, God is saying that now from the very beginning of life, there is going to be the reminder of death. From the very beginning to the most precious experience that we have, there's going to be the reminder that death is now a part of the world. And we know that the pain of childbirth sometimes is even more than just the actual pain of delivery. We know there is pain of children being born sometimes with serious problems. We know that there is the pain of mothers who sometimes die when they give birth. But don't miss this, that in the judgment, there is the promise that life will continue. God is saying there's going to be pain in childbirth, but he's also saying there's going to be children. I love Carl Sandburg's definition of a baby. He said a baby is God's opinion that the world should go on. And that's a beautiful thought. God is saying to Eve, the world is going to go on, but there's going to be pain when you bring life into the world. And the second thing that he says to her is that there is going to be sorrow in child rearing. Come on. The Hebrew word pain, by the way, it means sorrow. And when you couple that word with the word increase, the idea seems to be that the whole process of bringing children into the world and raising them now is going to be much more difficult, much more painful. I believe that a mother's built-in anxiety is one of the results of the fall. The latter part of chapter 10 of Proverbs, verse 1, says that a foolish son brings grief to his mother. Since the fall, we know that there have been millions upon millions of mothers who have known sorrow and heartache because sin is now a part of our existence and can capture their children. How many times, as Eve watched her own kids grow, she went through all the pain of Cain and Abel and many other episodes, how many times must she have thought, if only? Eve never thought when she ate that fruit that she was forfeiting the chance to raise children that would be born without sinful natures. Think about that. Think about giving birth to a child with no sinful nature. What a joy that would be. But we will never have that experience. Children are born inherently sinful creatures. I've preached a lot of bad sermons in my day. My first couple years as a baby preacher, it was all I could do to just get up into the pulpit and say anything. And I remember teaching one of my first year of sermons about where Jesus said that we need to become like little children. And I said, we should become like little children, like Jesus said, because children are sweet and children are honest and they're innocent. And I went on and on with a lot of that nonsense. And afterwards, one of the older women in the church came up to me and just patted me on my shoulder and said, just wait till you have children. Children are born with a nature that is predisposed to sin. And training that out of them is the difficult task of being a parent. Now, I want to look at a verse today. But I think Paul had this in mind when he said to Timothy and the church in Ephesus in 1 Timothy 2, a woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She must be silent. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. But women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety. That's a hard text. And at first, I thought about avoiding this text because it's controversial. Then I thought, nope, we need to look at this topic. Now, let me say right up front, if you want to know my position on the role of women in the church, then you need to know that if you are on either extreme, then I'm probably going to make you mad. If you are on the extreme that a woman can't do anything but sit in church and be still, then I'm going to make you mad, because when I read 1 Corinthians 11, I think that it clearly teaches that women prayed in the church. Women prophesied in the assembly. But if you are on the other extreme, and you are a feminist and you want to push that agenda, then I'm probably going to make you mad as well, because I think the Bible clearly says that the role of authoritative teacher and pastor of the church is the man's role, not the woman's. Now, what Paul is saying here is not that salvation is tied to fertility. He's not saying that a woman is saved because she can have kids. Some women are called to the single life. Some women can't bear children. Some women do their best to raise godly kids and they rebel. That's not what Paul is saying. He is not tying salvation to fertility. But he is saying salvation is reflected by one who submits to the design of God. Now, in the garden, that design was violated, and Eve usurped a role that she should not have had. And that same thing can happen in the church. And I think what Paul is saying is that it is not the design of God that women find their fulfillment in pastoring the church. It is God's design that they serve the church by raising God-fearing seed. You ask me, what is the role of women in the church? I'll tell you. The most important role there is, it's called mother. And the role of mother raising up godly kids, passing on faith, raising kids to know and to love Jesus. That's how the church survives. That's a woman's greatest role. It's her greatest challenge. It's her greatest contribution. It's her greatest commitment. And it's your greatest source of heartache. Every mother since Eve knows the sorrow and the pain and the heartache of trying to take a self-centered creature and to mold them into the love of Jesus Christ. That's part of what's happened because sin has come into this world. But third, I want you to notice this. There will be tension in marriage, he tells Eve. God told Eve that her desire would be for her husband, and he will rule over her. Now, what does that mean, that her desire will be for her husband? Some say that means that she's going to long for the man, and she's going to want his approval, and that's some kind of a bad thing. I don't think that's what it means, because I think that that kind of desire was there before the fall. I think they both desired each other. I think you get some help with this idea in the very next chapter, in chapter 4, when God tells Cain, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. That word, by the way, desire, it's the exact same word. The idea is of control or rule. So what God is saying here is that we are seeing the beginnings of the battle of the sexes. Just as Cain must struggle to rule sin because sin wants to rule him, so now man must struggle to establish headship in his home. In other words, sin has marred a woman's God-given desire to be a helper to her husband into a perverse urge for rivalry. Notice Eve's first act after she disobeyed God was to assume leadership over her husband. Now Adam is going to come into conflict with this desire. And ever since, men and women have been in conflict in marriage because of this desire. And the tragic consequence throughout history has been the ungodly, abusive domination of women. The greatest oppressor of women in the world is sin. Sin has corrupted both the willing submission of the wife and the loving leadership of the husband. Because the pull of sin is always towards dominating and not cherishing. And so today, most men don't understand loving leadership, and most women don't seem to want it. And so God is saying to Eve, you wanted to be independent of me? You wanted a self-centered existence and not a God-centered existence? Well, this is what it means, Eve. It means there is going to be pain and sorrow in your family. Raising kids, it's going to be so hard now. Having a strong marriage is going to be so difficult now. In the whole arena of relationships, which are so close to a woman's heart, there has been devastation and death. Sometimes we even say of a failed marriage, their marriage died. This is a serious judgment. And for the man, God says to Adam three things. First, there is going to be pain in labor. God said, through painful toil, you will eat. Then he says, by the sweat of your brow, you will eat. I've been reading the book of Job in my daily Bible reading. That's why I had that verse read at the very beginning of the service. Job chapter 7 verse 1 says, does not man have hard service on earth? Are not his days like those of a hired man? It's interesting that the word for toil when God speaks to Adam is the same word for pain when he's speaking to Eve. In other words, Eve, you're going to have pain in the whole arena of your family. And Adam, you're going to have pain in the whole arena of providing for your family. Now, Adam had to work before the fall. The curse is not that he must work. The curse is that there is going to be tiredness, weariness, soreness, frustration in labor. And that work that once made him feel energized and good would never bring that kind of satisfaction again. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. We thank God for our jobs. We thank God for our ability to provide for our families. But there are so many days that we come home and we are exhausted. And we are weary. And our jobs do not bring us the kind of fulfillment, the kind of joy that we wished that they would. Sometimes we feel trapped, but we got to wake up tomorrow and we got to go do it all over again. And that's part of what it means that paradise is lost. And then God says to Adam, there is going to be difficulty in provision. Not only is work going to be more painful, but the soil is now going to be more uncooperative. Cursed is the ground because of you, he told Adam. It will produce thorns and thistles. And remember when God said to the serpent, cursed are you above all the other animals. And now he's saying, cursed is the ground. What God has done is that because sin has been unleashed into the world, his creation is cursed. His creation is devastated. The plants and the animals, they're under the weight of sin. God had created a world that would provide for us. And now that world doesn't always cooperate. You don't have to go to Vegas to gamble. Just talk to Richard McMichael about farming. Just try farming for a while. I want you to think about what it must have been like for Adam to try and explain thorns to Abel. To be out in the field one day and he's tired and his muscles are sore and he hears a scream and there's his little boy and he's holding his hand and it's bleeding. And Adam goes over there and he pulls out a big thorn from his hand and Abel's crying and he says, Daddy, why do we have to farm here? It's so hard. There's all these thorns. Why did you have to pick this place? And Adam would have to say, well, son, when I first picked this place, there weren't any thorns. This is not how God meant for it to be. And I fear sometimes because in this country we have so much abundance that we forget how hard life is for most people in the world. For most of the people of the world, you don't have to explain the curse of the ground. They know it. For most people of the world, the Lord's Prayer is genuine. Lord, give us this day our daily bread. Because most of the people of the world, daily bread is all they have, if that. Three times in Genesis chapter 3, verses 16 through 19, God tells Adam, you will eat. And what he is saying is, Adam, I created a world where eating was not going to be a problem, but you unleashed evil into this world, and now it's going to be hard. Don't ever forget that most of the world is struggling for daily bread. And the world is not cooperating as it was created to because of sin. And when you see thorns and when you see thistles, it should remind you something's wrong. Paradise is lost. And finally, God said there is going to be brevity in life. The last part of Genesis 3:19, for dust you are and to dust you will return. So much for man's ambition to divinity. Satan said, if you eat of this fruit, you're going to be like God. God said, because you ate of this fruit, you're going back to dust. This is God's reminder of how mortal man is without him. What this means is that we have to live with the consciousness of mortality hanging over us. Every day we live with the fact that mortality hangs over us. The minute man is born, he begins to die. And most lives are effectively summed up on the gravestone with a little dash. James writes in chapter 4, what is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. That's how God meant for it to be, but that's not how he meant for it to be, but that's how it is now. And as Adam and Eve's descendants, all of these consequences that we have been discussing, we reap as well. These judgments will be realities for you and me until Jesus comes back. Now the question is, how do we respond to all of this? Are we going to respond with fatalism and go into a cynical funk, just say life is hard, or are we going to respond with faith? Well, let me show you how you need to respond. First, don't ignore the results of man's sin. I think there is almost a strange mercy in these judgments. Satan is going to try to fill your mind with propaganda to try to convince you that you can find paradise just by listening to him. If you'll just do what he says, if you'll try what he wants, if you go down the road that he wants to take you, then you will end up finding paradise. The purpose of these judgments is to counteract his subtle lies. Death and pain and toil and heartache are realities that we cannot escape. They are here to help us see ourselves as we really are. We are dust, and we desperately need mercy. So don't ignore these things. The thorns and the tension in the family and the backbreaking work, they're all there to remind us of the consequence of sin and the frailty of man without God. But there's something else that we need to respond in this. Don't doubt the reality of God's love. You see, you preach a sermon like this, and it's easy to get down. It's just, man, life is hard. And before you know it, you're getting down on God because he has allowed for life to be very hard. But I want to challenge as we close this morning to not see Genesis 3 as a story about human disobedience and divine displeasure. Genesis 3 is the beginning of the gospel. Genesis 3 is the story of God's dilemma of how to respond to the sinfulness of his own creatures. And the amazing thing is not that they are punished. The amazing thing is that they're still alive. They still live. Look with me at this verse from the Psalm 103. As far as the east is from the west, so far does he remove our transgressions from us. As a father shows compassion to his children, so the Lord shows compassion to those who fear him, for he knows our frame. He remembers we are dust. Now the question is, how can God do that? How can the God who said, if you eat of this, you will surely die, how can he end up in Genesis 3 and allow man to still live? How can he do that? Well, I want you to notice something that's very powerful. Notice in chapter 3 that God cursed the serpent. God cursed the ground. But he never cursed Adam, and he never cursed Eve. Now he allows them to experience the consequence of sin and judgment, but he never cursed the man and he never cursed the woman. How could he not? If he cursed the serpent for the sin, how could he not curse the man and the woman? Well, the answer is God intended to take the curse upon himself. That's what God was foreshadowing when he said to the serpent, from the seed of this woman is going to come one that's going to take you on. You'll bruise his heel, but he's going to crush your head. Even in Genesis 3, God knew that he would not curse the man and the woman because he would send his own son to receive the curse that they deserved. Think about these judgments. Does Jesus Christ know about pain in relationships, betrayal, and heartache and sorrow from his children? Does Jesus know about sweat like blood coming from his brow? Does he know about thorns? Does he know about death? Paul writes in Galatians 3, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us, for it's written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. The dilemma in Genesis 3 is this: how can God be just and still save these sinful people? And the answer is, God was going to pour out the curse that the man and the woman deserve, but God was going to get in the way of that curse and take the full blow of that on himself and be both just and the justifier. Several years ago, there was an article in National Geographic about a forest fire in Yellowstone National Park. One of the rangers, the article said, was walking up on a hill surveying the damage. And at the base of one charred tree, he noticed that there was a dead bird. So he took a stick and he flipped the carcass of the bird over. And when he did, three little chicks scurried out. That mother bird took her children to the base of the tree, knowing that the toxic smoke would rise. And then as the fire got closer and closer and the heat literally began to cook her, She would not save herself, but covered her babies with her wings. And the wrath and the heat came on her, but not her children. That is exactly what God knew would have to happen for man and woman to be saved. He would have to step in the way of his own fiery wrath and take their curse. I don't think it ever dawned on Satan the length that God was willing to go to redeem his children. And I hope this morning it's dawning on you. Because I believe with all of my heart, because of what Jesus Christ has done, one day we're going to regain paradise. And then there will be no more death, no more crying, no more pain, no more sorrow, no more heartache, because there won't be a curse anymore. That's why we worship. Not to obey a command just to come to church, but because when it dawns on us the lengths that our Father was willing to go to so that you and I might be saved, well, we just got to have a time and a place to say thank you. So let's do that. Amen. Let's worship God together. Why don't you stand up as we get ready to worship.